Welcome to the Sage of Three Paths podcast. We are three brothers who use this space to talk about a range of topics, anything from politics, race, anime, and pop culture, each giving our own perspectives and opinions. I'm the youngest, Mo Janna, also known as Junior Lab.
I'm the oldest, Okello, but my brothers call me AJ.
Middle child, Oz, aka Wizard King.
We three brothers.
One sec. We once again thank you for tuning in and joining us on this sometimes cathartic journey. Let's dive right in.
Done.
Okay, so guys, well, Fiona, I'll start with you. I had to give my brothers somewhat of a debrief about how I met you and why I know you. And I was like, all right, so for work, I had this training, which was motivational interviewing. That's the right title, right?
It is.
And Mo goes to me, oh, so she's like a motivational speaker. And I was like, kind of not. I mean, we did the whole training, which was like a day, and motivational interviewing was not really said. We were speaking about like philosophy and psychology, relationships, and how you speak to people, which I guess falls underneath that, but it very much wasn't like that. And Mo looks at me and goes, okay. So I basically said, there's a few people you meet in this world who really change the way you think. They have a profound change. And for me, in that course, speaking with you and how you were, I mean, here's an example, Mo. I don't know if I've told you this. I wore a do-rag to the meeting. Fiona, do you know what a do-rag is?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. What Oz has got on. My brothers and I had previously had a conversation how it's uncomfortable for us to wear a do-rag in our professional settings because of the negative connotations it has with it. But the actual reason for a do-rag is because our afro-y hair dries out really easily in this environment.
Mm.
So we have to like get our essential oils in it, wear the do-rag to help lock it in and help it grow and be healthy. So it's kind of like a normal thing for us, but we were afraid, I guess we didn't explicitly say afraid, but I will summarize as we were afraid to wear them in our professional settings. And because of that, I started wearing it in my professional setting, and every single person who saw me wear that, the first thing they say is, who's this gangster?
Oh, wow.
On the lines of that, yeah. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Yep. I had a similar experience myself. Well, yeah. I had a similar 100%. Experience myself.
Are these people eight?
No, this is a wide range. This is like,
wow.
All generations. All generations.
And we've all experienced that as well, for sure.
That's outrageous. I'm really sorry you've experienced that because...
Well, however...
I mean...
I rock up to your training. I've got my do-rag on, I've got my camera on, and you don't say a goddamn word about it. You don't even care. We're having deep psychological conversations, and the fact that I have a do-rag didn't take anything away from that, which in my books is awesome. It was the first experience of that.
Really?
100%.
I am astounded. I didn't even notice, to be honest. Didn't even notice.
Honestly, because... if you have a look now, you'll see that people don't do it, actually. I guess now that we've shifted towards everyone working from home, people actually are not comfortable to do that.
Interesting. I mean, yeah, there is this thing about working from home where we've kind of realised now that staff members are grown-ups and they will do the job from home. And actually, if you've got pink hair or you've got your do-rag or your pyjamas on or whatever, it doesn't make any difference to what you're doing, you can still do it. And I think there's something about the last 14 months or so that's kind of freed people up a little bit. I mean, some of the things I've seen on Zoom, you'd be mortified to hear, but I'm still in shock and awe at that statement, because especially in our profession, when we're in an empathic, caring, helping, supposedly non-judgmental profession, to find that sort of reaction and let me guess, it's been dismissed as a bit of banter or a bit of a, you know, a bit of a joke, you know, you're all 100%. Right, geezer, he won't take it the wrong way. And that shit makes me mad, because there's just, I mean, well, it shows you. I didn't even notice, AJ, to be honest.
So I've had to be like, here, chap, I have no relations with gangsters. That is a lie. I do know some gangsters, so okay, whatever.
You look like you got one sitting next to you right now.
Eh? With his do-rag on.
Who knows? Who knows? With my do-rag on, I just may
old mystery man over there.
So my whole long introduction is now going to be passed over to you, Fiona. So, who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, and welcome to the podcast. Thank you for sharing this space with us. For sure.
No problem. Pleasure to be here. I was really honoured to be asked, actually. I do a bit of this stuff from time to time, but I'm quite on the down low. I prefer just kind of doing the work rather than being all over social media and all the rest of it. So it's not something I believe massively in, if I'm totally honest, unless it's something meaningful, because I think, you know, too much of our world these days is on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, this, that and the other. Everybody's competing. Everybody's trying to be the best. Everybody's going, look at me. And it's a little bit narcissistic for me anyway. So I'm Fiona Palmer, and I run an organisation called Reflect Training and Consultancy. And what that does, we work nationally with statutory and non-statutory organisations around training that is psychologically informed or trauma informed. And it's about doing things in a totally different way, turning things on its head. And, you know, historically, we've had this very kind of hierarchical, marginalised, you know, kind of less than groups in our society, the way they've been perceived. And trauma-informed care is about meeting people where they're at and understanding that everybody holds some sort of trauma, you know, and that we need to be kind, actually, to people in the way that we work with them, and that the way that we kind of put policy and procedure into place. So I've worked in the police, in prison, in probation, social services, child protection. So I've been in the field for about 31 years, and I was a consultant forensic psychologist for quite a long time, and I worked in domestic abuse, sexual offending, high-risk violent offending, domestic homicide, and, you know, psychopathy. So quite a fun bag there. And about 5-6 years ago, I kind of took a step back, because things at the core were wrong. Mm-hmm. Policy was wrong. Procedure was wrong. Yeah. Sentencing was wrong. Risk assessment was wrong. We were a nanny state where we're trying to overdo and overcompensate for absolutely everybody's free thought. Impossible. And I wanted to try and kind of change things around a little bit. And the motivational interviewing that you're talking about there, AJ, it's a therapeutic dialogue of helping people that are stuck in behaviour want to change. That's what it's about. Hello.
Yeah, apologies. That was our grandmother who handed me her hot water bottle and didn't say a word, just handed it to me, just like, sort this out.
You know what to do.
Did say a water bottle?
That was brilliant. Brilliant. Hi, but, Grandma.
Apologies, because that obviously did take you run. But one thing that I'm quite curious about is, do you feel that you was always quite an empathetic person? Like, because all these roles that you're talking about, that comes with a great deal of empathy. So do you feel that you, that was like at the base, or did you have to develop that and that just kept growing like the further you went on in your career?
I think empathy is an interesting one. There's three types of empathy. There's empathy, there's cognitive empathy, there's emotional empathy, and then there's compassionate empathy. So cognitive is being able to think about somebody else's circumstance. Empathic empathy is feeling somebody else's. But the compassionate stuff is the feeling, the seeing, the hearing, and wanting to help. And for me, I was always a bit of a weirdo. Always a bit of a weirdo. I felt things too deeply. I cried at adverts. I come from a very strict Irish Roman Catholic family. Yeah, Jesus, no, will you? Sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. And you know, messed my head up for years and years and years because I believed the opposite. So, feeling very deeply, you know, some might say I'm quite Wiccan in my approach, and you know, I'm very highly empathic and always has been. And that's a blessing and a curse because it's really draining being massively empathic. Mm. And also, if you're not careful, your boundaries get really sketchy. Mm. You know, so you kind of give, and then you end up having a meltdown or a breakdown or whatever it is. And you just go, oh, well, how did I get here? And it's because you've just worn yourself out giving. So I think I've always important. Been massively empathic. But I do believe you can, unless you're a sociopath, obviously, or somebody with very high narcissistic traits, you can develop empathy. I think empathy gets jaded. You know, we talk about desensitization and compassion fatigue when we're just so overwhelmed with caring. But generally, in answer to your question, no, I have always been empathic and a bit of a rescuer, if I'm honest. You know, so that's been a bit of a challenge over the years, especially when you're working with very psychopathic individuals whose key skill is to manipulate you and make you feel sorry for them. That was fun. I would say yes, I have always been, if that answers your question.
So that's really interesting to hear, and I guess the one thing that came out to me when you was explaining that was, you know, you give, and then it gets to a point where actually, you know, you've overgiven and maybe you're a bit drained. That's something that I can relate to personally. That's something that I feel like I've been through, I've experienced. In that moment, what would you say is the thing that you're supposed to do? What's the right thing to do when you're in that moment? And I guess, how do you prevent yourself from getting to that place in the first place?
Well, usually you don't know that you're in that moment until something happens.
Yeah.
And it's usually when you've got a bad belly constantly, or you can't sleep, or you just feel tearful, or, excuse me, you've got that very strange type of tired where it's not just physical tiredness, but mental tiredness and a chest tiredness almost. So it's really insidious. It creeps up on you because if you're naturally empathic and you like to help people and you like to, you know, kind of work with people and you're all about people doing well, you forget about yourself. You're at the bottom of the list. And, you know, like I say in my course, I think you might have heard me say it, AJ, I don't like Richard Branson. I think he's a bit of a knob. But he did say, in order to help yourself, when your plane's going down, you've got to put your own oxygen mask on first before you help anybody else. And that's really, really profound because when you're in the place, you usually start to recognise it when you're not coping as well. We all have something called a window of tolerance, and the more stressed and worn out from giving we get, our window of tolerance just gets smaller. So things that normally wouldn't bother us send us into orbit, or, you know, we have disproportionate reactions to things. And when that happens to us, we need to just kind of stop and go, right, okay, where is this coming from? And what am I doing about my eating, sleeping, my downtime and my physical activity? Because we always put ourselves last. Always. So in order to not get to that place, I mean, that's a massive challenge if you're naturally empathic. you will get to that place, you know, and you'll come in and out of that place, but we become better at recognizing it. Okay. And the key is literally that. It's that oxygen mask stuff. Okay, it's all right to say no. It's all right to have boundaries with the emotional vampires and the joy hoovers in my life that just suck it all out of me. It's all right to, you know, kind of put myself first, go to bed early. And something, you know, that I thought about a couple of years ago, which I try and live by, is that I try to treat myself like a small child.
Yeah.
So a very small child that I have to feed and water and put to bed early and teach boundaries to, I try to live by that because it's true. You know, my my childhood punishments, as they say, are my adult goals now, going to bed early, staying in, cancelling plans, sitting here watching telly with my dogs. I mean, you know, living in a field in France, all good. But it's a difficult one because it's finding that balance between wanting to fix and save people and kind of knowing when you've done what you can. The thing is, we'll never change people. People will never change. What we can do is invoke the desire for them to change their situation or do something differently, but we can't make them do it. Yeah. And that's where a lot of our empathic energy goes, because we want to drag people down the right path. You know, if you just do this or buy that or say this or do this differently, then you too can be happiness. And we see this kind of, you know, right path for people. And then when they don't take it, shock horror, we're really drained and upset and we're just knackered from trying to help them when, you know, I mean, that's a long and convoluted... I did warn you, AJ, that I'd ramble. So long. Never ask a psychologist to come on a podcast.
No, oh, we're here for it.
That was a great answer.
Yeah, you are literally dropping gems. Well, so we are here for it.
With that, I want to go into how you even got into... how you started your career. Because... As an empath, the path you've taken seems like one where you'd be putting yourself in a situation where the possibility of becoming drained by dealing with, let's say, the bloodsuckers would be continual.
Mm.
So how did you
Interesting.
Go through this path?
Honestly, I had a shit childhood, mate. Absolutely shocking childhood. Love my dad very, very much. Very hard, cold man. Alcohol abuse in the family. My mum was an alcoholic, very severe alcoholic. A lot of domestic abuse. Couldn't wait to get out of the house at 16. Took a job in the Royal Bank of Scotland because they were paying me stupid money at the age of 16, and I bought myself a briefcase and everything to go there. It's really exciting. Never thought about the fact that I'd absolutely hate anything to do with banking and I couldn't count. And kind of left home, became very disillusioned with that very quickly. So kind of jobbed about doing that and various other silly jobs. Went travelling for 3 years at 18 to the Middle East. So I went on a kibbutz and came back through Europe, finding myself. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, you go away and you can be anybody you want. Nobody knows you. Nobody knows your history. But actually, that's where I really started to learn about myself and really sort of, you know, realised that I was quite a strong person and... you know, this stuff didn't define me. You know, lots of people, as I say, have trauma. You know, so that was that part. And then I came back and did something really stupid, which I'm quite well known for, not so much now, but very much so when I was younger. Met somebody, whirlwind romance, got married very, very quickly at the age of nearly 22. I thought he had depression. It turns out he had schizophrenia. And so began my domestically abusive marriage. And I had a baby within 14 months of getting married. And that was very difficult because, you know, you have the empathic stuff. He doesn't mean to. It's because he's ill. You have the Catholic guilt. Marriage is forever. Sickness and in health and all of that sort of stuff. So... It was really, really tough to kind of get out of that situation. you know, but I had to because I had a young baby and it was dangerous and I wasn't really left with a lot of choice. And as a result of that, I started volunteering for Women's Aid down in Wales for a little while. And I started working in a substance misuse centre as well as a volunteer while my daughter was still small before she started school. So that was kind of that. And then I decided that I wanted to continue with my studies, which I did. So the psychology and then the forensic psychology. And then I came back to England because my dad wasn't very well. And the rest, as they say, is history. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. It's that lived experience stuff. And, you know, we talk about adverse childhood experiences, don't we? There's a big model out at the moment that's used in trauma about adverse childhood experiences. It's made up of 10 statements before your 18th birthday. Was somebody physically abusive to you? Were they sexually abusive? Was there neglect? Were your needs met? Was there divorce, illness, so on and so forth? And on that model, I score out at 8 out of 10.
Wow.
Yay. Damn. And, you know, I don't mind being open about that stuff because when you work with people, especially in the helping professions, if you've got somebody, for example, in active addiction or somebody who's street working or somebody who's fleeing domestic abuse, and they think that, it's called social disaffiliation, disconnected from society, what the perception of normal society, the 2.4 children, lovely money in the bank kind of family is. And they think they're never going to be able to achieve or change or come through. But you can. You can.
Those societal pressures.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, it was through lived experience, through having no power as a child and kind of wanting to work with that and wanting to understand. You know, one of my specialisms is domestic abuse, and most people that perpetrate domestic abuse, and stats tell us that it's a gender-based crime. You know, I sit on the board of Women's Aid, and my stats tell me that it's a gender-based crime. Women are more likely to be survivors than men. I think that there's a lot of flawed reporting in those stats because men massively underreport. People from the LGBTQ community massively underreport. But we have to work with what we've got and what we know. And most people that perpetrate domestic abuse aren't psychopaths, aren't masochists. They've had exposure to it in their childhoods or cultural expectations, or it's always been that way. And, you know, most people just need to take a step back and kind of analyse what it is about their upbringing, their biases, their judgments, their cultures that gives them permission to act in this way. Don't get me wrong, we do have a small percentage of people with narcissist personality disorder or people that are psychopathic that do perpetrate these kind of offences, but generally, you know, most people, it's learned behaviour again.
Welcome to the Sage of Three Paths podcast. We are three brothers who use this space to talk about a range of topics. Anything from politics, race, anime, and pop culture. Each giving our own perspectives and opinions. I'm the youngest, Mo Jana, also known as Junior Lam.
I'm the oldest, Okello, but my brothers call me AJ.
Middle child, Oz, aka Wizard King.
Why people do what they do really interests me. It always has done. And my favourite question is why? So, I mean, what better profession, really?
Yeah.
And
why?
To add to your statistics, just a quick one. I, myself, am what you would consider a survivor, where I've experienced domestic abuse from a female in a relationship, from a woman, a woman in a relationship. So it's not to say that trumps all the data you got, but
No.
What I've noticed is, you know, as you say, men underreport. Unless you're they're really comfortable to say, which is difficult to get to that position anyway.
Especially when there's toxic masculinity around, and you can't really have this conversation with your friends or the people that are close to you. I didn't know that, AJ. Absolutely. You know, that's something that I didn't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, with what you're saying with the perpetrator, I'm at a point in my life where I understand. Like, I can look at, I can look at this individual and I can look at the life around them and the information I know of their upbringing, which is not like I know everything. It's not that at all. But what I do know, I'm able to, and in a weird way, it kind of feels like I'm making excuses for them, but I'm able to understand why this person didn't have the power to not do this.
Mm.
It's really,
I'm interested
weird.
In what you said there. You said, it sounds like I'm making excuses for them.
Mm. Yeah, because the at the end of the day, the act is just wrong. But when you're conducting the act, you're committing the wrong.
Mm. You lose your right to access to the high ground in any situation. As soon as you dip to that level, there's no way you can then regain the high ground to come correct in terms of like a parlay or conversation.
Sure.
Or trying to sort something out. But sorry, carry on.
Well, and you know, don't get us wrong. We come in from an African background. Our grandmother would tell us the culture in her younger years was, if your husband doesn't beat you, he doesn't love you.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
Is, which is insane.
Insane.
Insane concept. Insane. Yeah.
Yeah.
Irish culture is very similar. You know, it's expected. And even in this country, you know, it's only in the last 20 years or so. You know, certainly when I was growing up, the police would come because the neighbours would call them or whoever. And the police would be like, oh, well, it's only a domestic. It's behind closed doors. You know, man's got the right to rape his wife. Man's got the right to beat his wife. But going back to what you said, Oz, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I think you do lose that higher ground.
However,
when you...
sorry to interrupt, but however...
No, carry on.
Again, where I am in my life right now, I see things where the root of punishment doesn't solve the issue or tends usually not to. We need to, in some ways, rehabilitate. And when we're going to go down the route of rehabilitation, I think it starts with forgiveness. It starts with forgiving yourself. You know, I'm not a perfect individual. I've lived my life and I've had my flaws, but you got to be able to forgive yourself. And once you do forgive yourself, you can start building up from there. And that's why I think, although the act is wrong, if you're able to get to a point where you can forgive the perpetrator, I don't think that's a bad thing. And I think that's where I am as well.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because this thing of forgiveness, you know... Are we forgiving? Just because we forgive someone doesn't mean, A, that we need to continue to allow them access to us. It doesn't mean that, you know, we need to engage with them ever again or anything like that. And I think, you know, staying angry and bitter is like expecting somebody else to die if you drink poison. Do you know what I mean? It just, the only person it kind of damages is you. So the forgiveness is, for me, it's a form of self-love almost. I can be in a place just because I, you know, the thing is, I understand why people abuse children. That doesn't mean I agree with it.
Yeah.
But I understand where those behaviours come from to a certain degree.
Like
I profile a person
It's an unpopular opinion, but I think that just sending them in prison doesn't solve anything. It hasn't solved anything. We really need to try and understand and rehabilitate, work with, and try and get people to overcome whatever addiction to the taboo.
It reminds me...
Well, it's interesting. Sorry, go on, Oz.
Just a quick one. So it reminds me of...
No,
it's a line from an artist, Mike Skinner. It's something that I've heard and it's stuck with me for years and years, that people never change, they just become more exposed. So it's this notion of the end goal or the end product of whoever you are is almost written already. So you're heading in that direction. If so, kind of tagging on to what you're saying, that people just, they don't change. You shouldn't really be expecting them to change. But is that truly the only option? Like, how, like, you're in a role where you are trying to fix and essentially change people, change their way of thinking. Now, you've made a career out of that. So can people actually change? Because that's obviously counterproductive in terms of what you what we have said before and what Mike Skinner said.
I think there's no black and white answers to that. I think the first thing, in the context of domestic abuse, again, statistically, people that go through a 9-month rehabilitation program around domestic abuse, it's based on the Duluth model, which is an American organization in Minnesota. It's a 9-month model, has the lowest recidivism rate across the board in criminal justice, which means the lowest rate of reoffending. So when we put people onto that program, we screen them, obviously, to make sure they're not psychopathic, because we don't want to be giving people tools to perpetrate further abuse. That's, you know, that, because that would be, yeah, wrong. But it's got the lowest rate of reoffending for people that have successfully completed that 9 months, and that's between 6 and 8 hours a week for 9 months of looking at themselves, looking at where they come from, looking at the messages they've received, looking at who they are and their place in the world and what's important to them, and starting to understand themselves. Once they've kind of, it's almost like they colour themselves in, and once they understand all the fragments of themselves, they tend to go away and change their behaviour. So perhaps I made the wrong statement when I said people don't change. What I mean was, people that don't want to change, don't change.
Yeah. You can't make people
change. I'm with you. Okay, that makes perfect sense.
People, we can't make people change. Yeah. They have to want to change. Because, you know, if perhaps I phrased that wrong. That's what I meant. Because if I believe that people wouldn't change, then I've just been chatting absolutely
literally
for 30 years.
This is your career. Like, somehow,
my career's built on air.
Somehow you've got a roof chatting over your head, right?
Fake it till you make it.
Just living in the south of France.
I know.
I mean, no, it's good that we clarified that, because, you know, when we're talking about empathy and trying to help people, we try to make people change. We try to make them change their behaviour. Mm. What we need to do is get people to look at their own behaviour and decide whether they want to change. And then we can support them.
Mm.
You know, if you've got somebody that's in what we call cluster B personality difficulty on the continuum of antisocial behaviour right through to psychopathy, chances of a psychopath changing slim to none, because they've got no need to. But generally speaking, most other people can address their behaviour if they're willing to look at themselves. And that's the key. It's about getting people, in motivational interviewing, for example, we call it developing discrepancy. So on the one hand, while you're using On Top of Your Script, the other hand, you want to be in college this time next year. What do you think needs to change here? How do you think this is going to work out for you? And it's about getting people to develop their own discrepancy in their behaviour and what they're saying they want. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting point. And just touching back on something you said, I guess, when you explained how you got into the job that you did, that you're doing, sorry. And it's almost as if, because you lived that experience, that cycle was something you wanted to break and you made that decision to break. I guess that's the discrepancy that you was able to pick from. Or depict from. Is there a way, or do you think that everybody has the ability to break the cycle, or have a moment where they can break a cycle that they're a part of? Maybe they've been abused and then they end up being abusive to their partner or to their children. Is there a point on that journey where they can make that decision?
Yes, if they've got insight. If they've got insight into their behaviour, yes. If you've got somebody who's completely, people often say to me, how do you treat narcissistic personality disorder? And I always say, you don't, you treat everybody around them. Because People with that sort of personality type don't have empathy. They don't have remorse. They don't worry or think about anything like that with other people. I mean, for example, we worry about our future selves, don't we? So I might think, oh, I'm not going to drive my car out on that icy road today in case something happens to me and I hurt myself. A narcissist process or somebody who's sociopathic would think, okay, I need to go and drive my car on the road out there. And if anything happens to me, then so be it, but I'm going to do it anyway. And they wouldn't have the same process of thinking around that we would, because they don't have the ability to feel empathy or worry or remorse. But most people will have the opportunity to break any sort of cycle. If we can, you know, if we've got somebody with no insight into their behaviour at all and they're completely all over the shop, it's about understanding why they're all over the shop and then looking for the point of the cycle that you might be able to do some work with. But generally speaking, people that have capacity, that engage in behaviour, that don't have those sorts of disorders, will feel shame, will feel remorse, will feel upset or disconnection brought on by their behaviours, addiction being a classic example. So, you know, I think everybody with insight who's not on that spectrum of psychopathy has the ability to change, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Does that answer your question, or did I wamble on again?
No, yeah, that was a great answer, thank you.
One thing that resonated with me, Fiona, is talking of your origin of how you got into the roles that you've gone through. It was you left the UK and spent 3 years abroad. And in that wilderness, you was actually able to find yourself to say, oh, actually, this is the person who I am. This is the person who I want to be going forward. And that really resonated with me, to be honest, because I've done basically the exactly same thing. Now, that's not to piggyback onto your upbringing, because mine was, of course, totally different. But I did make a choice to escape, if you will, I can use that, from the UK, and I spent some time in Barcelona. I mean, almost 4 years. And whilst I was out there, I also made a decision not to stay in contact with my family, with my brothers. Obviously dealing with my own demons whilst I was out there, but truly, whilst I was there, and it's like you said, you can be whoever you want, nobody knows you, you create this whole persona for yourself. But after a while of a fake persona, that got far too tiring. So on my arrival back to the UK, or leading up to my decision to come back, really and truly, I feel like I found the person who I want to be. Now, I guess that's not something that's going to resonate with everybody, because everybody's on their own path. But for me, truly, going into that wilderness was perhaps the only way at the time I felt was the only way I was able to find the person who I am now. Someone who I can be quite happy with going to bed at night, rather than at some points it would be cold sweats because I'm so stressed with work, with not knowing the language, with the culture, not talking to my family. So, yeah, for sure. I just wanted to touch on that because that was something that did resonate with me.
I hear you. And I didn't, I think I spoke to my dad probably 3 or 4 times when I was away. Not very often. And I only came back, bizarrely, because I broke my foot kicking the tree and I didn't have any travel insurance. Messing about, kicked a tree. Yeah, tree was 500 years old. My foot wasn't.
Got beat up by a 500-year-old tree.
Yeah, got beaten up by a tree. And I had to come home because I couldn't afford the medical treatment. And it wasn't my choice. And my plan was only to be back for like a couple of weeks and go off again. I was going off to India to travel with some people that I'd met. And, you know, for me, just being out there, and I think in our culture, you know, the eldest one of the eldest one has all this responsibility and everything else. And, you know, I didn't mention that my mum was killed when I was 14 and my sister was 12. She was hit by a car, but because she was drunk, there was a big high court situation going on and so on and so forth. So I had a lot of responsibility there with managing my dad, managing my sister. My dad was very angry and, you know, upset and all the rest of it. And I took off as soon as I could because the stress of it all just was... So I totally hear you on that. And I didn't want anybody making demands on me, anybody kind of, you know, pulling at me or tugging at me. I just wanted to just go and just be. Mm. And what I found was actually having that space, I found my natural personality. I didn't need to be showing this brave face all the time or, you know, kind of fixing everything for everybody or managing everything for anybody, because I am a natural rescuer. Even now at the age of nearly 50, I'm a natural rescuer. I can't help it. So yeah, I totally hear. And I remember coming back and my sister picked me up in a mini Clubman. And of course I had a size 10 trainer on my foot with lolly sticks holding my toes together because I couldn't afford to get my foot treated. Foot out the window all the way up the M25 from Heathrow, and got back to my dad's house and saw him. And when I saw him, he looked so old and so frail and so diminished compared to the way he was in my mind that you know, it kind of was quite sobering. And I, you know, we get on great now. He's nearly 90 now. He's got dementia, bless him. But, you know, it was an important time in my life, really. So, it's a similar thing where you just don't talk to people because you just, do you know what, I just can't. I can't, it's too much.
Do you know what, that was one of my fears whilst I was abroad of coming back. A situation with a particular family member would have diminished. Like, that's, for me, that's quite key. Like, so I would say we had a death in the family just before I left. It was one of our brothers, cousin. And that rocked the family hard. And perhaps that played some role, whether fairly small, in my decision to make a move. But whilst I was there, I was thinking, okay, what if something happens to grandma? She's already getting on in years. Now, if I'm away and not actually communicating with everyone, the bridges that we all had with each other, I'm just flicking matches left, right and centre.
Yeah.
And coming back, I was like, thank goodness we can actually... Like, you saw, she walked into the room, basically threw the hot water bottle at me. No words. So... Honestly, I feel blessed that I was able to come back and actually still be there to enjoy everyone's company and everyone's life.
Do you know, she used to ask, she used to ask us every now and then during the time you were away, she would be, so if I died right now, he's just not here. He just, no one can talk to him. No one can tell him anything. And I was like, yeah, grandma.
That was one of my biggest fears, but just for anyone in the family. Obviously, grandma's just one example. That was for anyone in the family. But
it's see, funny, isn't it?
Even gangsters have feelings.
Preach, bro, preach.
No, it's real talk, though. It's real talk. Everybody's got feelings, and it's deep for a lot of people. I don't know. I can't relate because I guess I've not had that same feeling, but I guess just hearing your side a bit more about it, and I guess just the fact that you went through that experience and you was able to grow and really define or discover who you are and who you wanted to be. I think those years, time heals all. So I think it's good that you came back and, you know, things were still in place, people were still alive. But even if that wasn't the case, that shouldn't be something that you blame yourself for. That's the one.
I think if I'm being honest with myself, I think I would have lived with that quite close to my heart, and I would carry that guilt with me if that was the case. Obviously, God forbid. But I hear you, man. Time heals all. But the main thing is just open and honest conversations, because we're not all right. if I'm being honest, we're not all right day to day. Like, we need to be able to have someone who you can lean on, or to call, or just a text or whatever, so you can vent if needs be. I think that's so key. And in my adult life now, I'm really understanding the people closest to me are these friends, family, tools almost, who are, we can mutually use each other in order to just work on our mental health.
Hey, Okello here. This section is a space where we'll be sharing short stories, creative experiences, and art. Ahmed Sekou Touré, 1922 to 1984. Sekou Touré was the first president of Guinea. He's revered across French West Africa for being the first president to have dared to say no to France. In 1958, French President Charles de Gaulle, under pressure to grant independence to French colonies, organized a constitutional referendum. African colonies had the choice to approve the constitution and be gradually granted independence or become independent right away. Guinea is the only country that rejected the constitution and demanded its independence. In a famous speech, Touré said, "It is better to be poor and free than to live in opulence and be a slave."
With calmness and stillness, it comes to an end. We hope you found some gems and go away richer in soul and spirit. We're showing you the three paths of the sage. Your path is your own. Which path do you follow? Until next time.